Welcome to TechNation Health, reimagining the future of health and healthcare with the emergence of new technologies and breakthrough science. Today on TechNation Health, Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft talks about the reality of big data in healthcare. And Dr. Ajay Gupta from Rockwell Medical tells us about the challenge of getting the right amount of iron to very ill patients. The answer comes from the work of a French chemist in the 1800s. And now, Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft.
We live in this exponential age where our digital environment can pick up huge amounts of data, from our tracking our steps and our sleep, from our wearables, to the massive amount of information that's in our electronic medical records, including imaging data, to our own gene sequences, which you can now get for less than $1,000 and store in the cloud, to all the information from our social networks and beyond. But most of that data is very siloed and hard to access. It doesn't come together. You know, and a good example of where we can leverage big data, and we do it every day, is, let's say, our weather data. We use the National Oceanographic Association has an API that now can sync to your smartphone app, which gives you data information. That might be leveraging everything from a map of your local environment to the pollen counts to the traffic. What if we took some of that same sort of big data elements, including your digital health exhaust, your microbiome, your genomic information, your clinical data, started to layer up and make it much more accessible, because it's the combination of those data streams that's going to lead us to this world of more precision, personalized, proactive healthcare. And there's some pretty interesting examples of this coming together. In exponential medicine, we had John Brownstein, who's the head of innovation at Boston Children's Hospital in Boston, where I trained in pediatrics. They're doing some really interesting work now to take the big data from imaging. You know, they do, let's say, hundreds or thousands of brain MRIs on kids, some with certain genetic and other issues. They're now working with GE and others to start to understand the signals in some of those that you can sort of add that sort of information layer in a scan done outside of Boston. So there's not a lot of pediatric radiologists in the world. You can start to augment that with the big data mashed up with AI to start informing better diagnostics.
So collective data is going to be telling us a lot more about the human condition.
Well, it's collective and crowdsourced in a sense. You know, my favorite example, I think we've spoken this in prior episodes here, is that it was 10 years ago this fall that the first iPhone came out. Before that, we were still driving pretty much with paper maps. And now we couldn't imagine driving without Google Maps or Waze. That's crowdsourced driving data based on your shared information, what's your speed and location on the streets. That's pretty private data if you think about it. But we wouldn't want to give that up, because we want the traffic and we want to get to where we're going. We could think about that same level of crowdsourcing data from multiple elements, from our genomics, from our medical record, from our tweets, from our connected home data, the Internet of Medical Things, and use that in smarter ways. And we're starting to see that enter the hospital situation. Let's say I've spent a lot of time working in, say, intensive care units. You're looking at a lot of data off in a spreadsheet. It's not easy to synthesize that in your brain. You want to be proactive before a patient gets septic, has a blood infection, and you have to start antibiotics and draw blood culture. What if you could pick that up an hour or 5 hours early based on subtle changes in blood pressure, heart rate, temperature that you wouldn't normally see by looking at the data in a human way, and pulling that together to act earlier and hopefully, you know, keep that infection from becoming life-threatening or very expensive to treat. So we're seeing sort of the ability now in an average intensive care unit to collect that data and the ability to maybe make sense of it and mash it up and use that for making decisions about when to take the breathing tube out, when to treat a patient more in a more personalized way, how to staff your hospital. You know, what's the weather? Is it a full moon? Is there a big football game? Are you expecting more accidents? You might literally staff your hospital up using some of that kind of information.
And full moon makes a difference.
I think that's been studied. It's a bit of a misnomer. That's a bit of a joke that it's been looked at. And I think the data shows it really doesn't make a difference. But there's lots of lore about, you know, when women come in to deliver babies, et cetera, based on the moon. And some of it may, if you look at the right data in the right form, give us information. But one of the terms coined by John Brownstein and others is this idea of a digital phenotype. Each of us now can be exuding all sorts of information, again, from our omics that might be changing, like our microbiome, to how much we're tweeting, to how much sleep, to where we're driving and how fast, that can be used in really interesting ways, including in population health. So let's say you're worried about, you can take a common platform like Yelp. And one of the most common uses is when people complain that they got a bad GI infection from going to a restaurant. You can start to mine information from Yelp and find hotspots of, here's a restaurant that might need to be looked at, or public health information around the world, digital disease detection, where we can look at the web of information and pull out the data points and predict that Ebola is coming up or Zika and look at its transmission and spread based on where people are searching for symptoms or searching about their GI symptoms might be mean that there's a flu blood coming through. So lots of ways we can start to leverage this big data across healthcare, particularly in public health, where the ability to rapidly assess and respond can save thousands or millions of lives.
It's one thing to have HIPAA protecting data about us, our health data, but now we're talking about massive amounts of health data. I can't even imagine getting my hands around my own health data.
Right. We're in this era of exploding data, but data doesn't translate to actionable information that you can use as Moira, or I can use as Daniel, or I can use on my patients, or a hospital system, or pharma can leverage. So the challenge is to make it digestible and actionable. And that's where I think the exciting combination of big data with machine learning and AI is coming together so that I don't want to look at my raw step data or sleep information. I want to see this synthesized score, which I already can get with some of the wearables I have from this ring that tracks my sleep to my Apple Watch. We want to be able to transmit that to a clinician who can see it in their workflow on a day-to-day basis. No clinician now wants your big data. They want to see your check engine light. They want to understand, oh, wow, something's changed in Moira's resting heart rate at night going from 60 to 75. Something's going on. I might want to call her. We might learn from other information about you to really tune that proactive phone call or to pick it up even before things have changed. So the real crux of this is to bring this all together, integrate into the workflow, protect the information with things like HIPAA, which frankly is a well-meaning law but a bit outdated. It's supposed to be the Healthcare Portability Act and privacy. The Portability Act part has gone away in many cases and can be a barrier to innovation. But to leverage these tools so that you as an individual, myself as a clinician or a healthcare system or a payer, can take that big data and be, again, proactive and not wait for disease to happen, but use the sort of signals and find the needle in a haystack that can be actionable.
This is the old information is data in context. And it's like, yeah, worry a little about your data, but you really are looking for the information. What's the synthesis of it?
The synthesis of the information and then how to use that in a more seamless way. I mean, today we talk about the Uberization of healthcare and new companies have sprouted up that are kind of becoming the Uber meets transportation needs for patients, where they can get to the clinic when they need to. They can leverage the big data of whether now, let's say you have a child with asthma, you can look at the big data synthesized of the pollen counts and be proactive about picking their starting on their steroid inhaler earlier. You might be a public health worker in D.C. looking at patterns of flights and infections in Europe and being proactive about who you might want to screen when they come to the United States. So this is really a very interesting era, and the need for new data scientists and the merger of information and AI and machine learning into healthcare is really at its interesting crux. And part of the focus of what we saw this year at Exponential Medicine is that it's moving from big data to actionable information we can use across the healthcare continuum.
Well, Daniel, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Mara.
Dr. Daniel Kraft is chief correspondent of TechNation Health and the founder and chair of Exponential Medicine. More information is available at exponentialmedicine.com. We all know that we need iron, but the chronically ill are particularly challenged. Dr. Ajay Gupta is the chief scientific officer of Rockwell Medical.
Patients who have chronic inflammatory conditions, for example, cancer, patients with kidney failure, patients who have chronic infections, they have very high levels of this molecule called hepcidin, which is produced from the liver. Hepcidin not only blocks the absorption of iron from the gut, but it also prevents the iron release from the iron stores in the body. Therefore, the body may have iron, but it cannot be released from the storage system. Iron is normally stored in these cells called macrophages. So hepcidin blocks the release of iron from the macrophages, so it cannot get to the iron carrier in the blood, which is the protein transferrin, which is what carries it to the bone marrow, where it is utilized to make hemoglobin within the freshly made red blood cells.
So you want to have the iron get to the transferrin, and then the rest will take care of itself.
That is correct. That is correct.
So a number of years back, you were scratching your head, saying, how do we do this? So what'd you do?
Yes, indeed. I was actually in 1995 working as a nephrologist at Henry Ford Hospital.
And a nephrologist is?
A kidney doctor. And the idea occurred to me that during the process of dialysis, as we are removing the toxins from the body, we are also infusing into these patients molecules like bicarbonate, like calcium. So I thought, why don't we infuse iron? These patients lose iron with every dialysis session. And therefore, I thought that if I could put iron into the dialysis solution, then it will slowly go across the dialyzer membrane. And then I wanted to have an iron that would directly bind to transferrin. Unfortunately, all the iron compounds that are currently in use are these large globules of iron. It has thousands of iron ferric oxide atoms or molecules in the central core, surrounded by a shell of carbohydrate. And the idea of the carbohydrate shell is to prevent the iron from coming in direct contact with the cells, because iron can be potentially very toxic. So these large globules are insoluble and they cannot be added to the dialysis solution. They won't transfer across the dialyzer membrane because they are too big. So I had to go back to the old history from the 1800s. And indeed, the scientists in 1800s, they wanted to infuse iron intravenously into the patients who cannot tolerate oral iron. And there are a lot of patients who cannot tolerate oral iron. They have gastrointestinal side effects, etc. So first they started infusing these iron salts, like, for example, iron ascorbate. But these salts will fall apart in the circulation and the free iron will be very toxic. And it would cause respiratory distress and the blood pressure will go down. And many patients, in fact, died because of these compounds being infused. But then I discovered that a French chemist, Rabecque, back in 1857, had synthesized an iron salt called soluble ferric pyrophosphate. Rabecque, in his oration before the French Academy, noted that the iron was highly concealed in this iron salt. Its properties were masked. It was highly soluble compound, and it was highly stable. So I thought this would be perfect. And as I started looking into it, more properties of this compound came out, which were already known, that the pyrophosphate component of this molecule, in fact, promotes the iron transfer very rapidly to this protein, iron carrier transferrin. And in fact, the transferrin molecule has a binding site for pyrophosphate. So this was perfect. This was like a laser-guided bomb.
We fly directly to your city. Great.
Exactly. Exactly. And therefore, I went to the FDA. I started these phase two trials with the food-grade material, which was available. The trial was highly successful. And subsequently, the FDA asked me to make a pharmaceutical-grade iron salt, which received a new name called ferric pyrophosphate citrate. We did a number of toxicology studies. Then we did our phase three studies, which were highly successful. And the drug was approved by the FDA in the U.S. in 2015. And the drug has been used in the U.S. market over the last 2 years, very successfully, without any side effects. The unique thing about this drug is that it is very, very safe. Every single component of the drug, the iron, the pyrophosphate, and the citrate, are physiologic. So there are certain problems with the current intravenous iron formulations that are used, these iron carbohydrate complexes, because the carbohydrate can cause these catastrophic reactions, anaphylaxis, because the body reacts to the carbohydrate. And the patients can develop respiratory distress, hypotension, their blood pressure goes down into their boots, and they have a cardiovascular collapse. And many patients, in fact, die from these reactions. Because this compound, triferic, does not have any carbohydrate or sugar moiety, therefore, it has negligible risk of anaphylaxis. And in fact, we have administered now more than 150,000 doses of Triferic and haven't had a single instance of anaphylaxis. So that appears to be a major advantage of this drug. Also, there are other benefits in terms of the intravenous iron, as I mentioned before, gets sequestered in the scavenger system of the body, the macrophages. But Triferic is able to overcome this functional iron deficiency. So these patients who have inflammation, like cancer patients, patients with kidney disease, they may have enough iron in the body, but it's not getting to transferrin. And that is called functional iron deficiency. And Triferic is the only iron compound delivered directly into the circulation that is able to overcome this functional iron deficiency without causing a tissue iron overload. And as you realize, iron can be highly toxic. That's why the body has these mechanisms to prevent too much iron getting into the body. And that's exactly what happens with intravenous iron, the traditional intravenous iron, that it causes this tissue iron overload, which can be potentially very harmful. And that is avoided by the use of Triferic.
This is such a great story in so many ways. One is that you went back centuries to see what was going on. Most of the scientists I know, they're having a hard time reading all the papers that are being published now. They figure what's now is, you know, that's the latest, greatest. How hard is it to go back several centuries to see what was published and what was used then?
Well, I was fortunate that I had very good resources at hand at the hospital where I was working, and I had very good support, and I was able to go back to the literature from the 1800s and hence discovered this particular iron salt, which really is a fantastic molecule.
Now, you couldn't just walk through the front door of the library and they had the book sitting there, right?
Indeed. We had a very good librarian who became my friend, and she helped me in this process. All this literature was not necessarily online, and we had to really dig deep, and she had to dig deep to find what I was looking for.
You mentioned that the scientists spoke to the National Academy in France. He didn't give that lecture in English.
The transcript that I had was in English. I'm not sure if he delivered his oration in French or in English. I suspect you are right that this must have been in French and then subsequently translated into English.
I think it's very interesting, the idea that the primary compound you're looking at has been shielded and masked. This is a major concept. It kind of comes packaged, prepackaged to the patient.
Indeed. The iron in this particular salt is so highly concealed that even when you treat this molecule with nitric acid, the iron does not get released. And it's actually a very elegant concept. The iron stays very tightly bound to the pyrophosphate in the circulation. And the pyrophosphate lets go of the iron only when it sees a transferrin molecule swing by.
A transferrin come by.
Exactly. And because the transferrin binds that iron 10 times more strongly than pyrophosphate does. So pyrophosphate will let go of the iron so that it can bind to transferrin. But in the meantime, while the iron is bound to pyrophosphate very tightly, it is not visible to the cells, and therefore it doesn't have any toxicity. It does not induce any oxidative stress, which is a major problem with the traditional intravenous iron compounds. The other issue is infections. So I think we increasingly recognize that intravenous iron causes infections because iron serves as a nutrient for bacteria. Triferic, on the other hand, is very physiological type of iron. It is like eating a steak. And in our phase 3 trials, which are placebo-controlled, we see that the incidence of infections with Triferic is identical or is same as placebo. Therefore, this is a unique iron, a very physiological iron that does not increase the risk of infections. And infections are a major problem in patients who are inflamed, like dialysis patients, patients with cancer, because of the immunocompromise that these patients have. And I think that's a very significant beneficial effect of this particular iron salt, other than not causing anaphylaxis and being very physiological and not inducing oxidative stress.
I like the idea that it comes with its own wrapper. Does this give you any ideas for drug discovery in the future?
Indeed, I think this whole concept that Robicoe invented of concealing drugs is now becoming widespread with nanotechnology and nanomedicine. And credit goes to Robicoe for actually describing this concept for the very first time.
Dr. Ajay Gupta is the Chief Scientific Officer of Rockwell Medical. More information is available at rockwellmed.com. For Tech Nation Health, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Muller, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcor. We'll be right back.